Vancouver Institute, this remarkable institute that goes on year after year, every Saturday night during the winter and spring terms of the university. I'm Patricia Marchak, and I have the honor of introducing the speakers for this session. But before I do that, let me remind you that you can take out memberships in the Institute if you wish to do so. They're extremely cheap. They're so cheap that I keep telling Peter Nemetz, who is the guiding light of this Institute, that maybe you should put up the money and then everybody would think it's even more special than it is. Maybe they'd pay more. We don't pay our speakers for the most part. We ride on the coattails of all the other speaking engagements that are happening at the university, and we approach the various special lectureships and ask them if we can just get this person to stay over the Saturday night and give us a lecture. And of course, our own professional faculty at UBC give many of the lectures. Everyone donates their time free. We do have some expenses, however. They are, of course, the rental of the room and payment for technicians. And as you know, because you've seen so many wonderful displays of technical magic here, that is a very important part of the lectureships and why we have them in this building where we have multi-dimensional technical capacities. And also we have some other expenses of just keeping the whole thing going. So we'd be very happy indeed if you would like to take out memberships, which, as I say, are very, very cheap. I mean, what a bargain. Where else could you go on a Saturday night for $10 if you're a student, or $25 for a whole family? How could you take your whole family out on a Saturday night and get a wonderful lecture, a wonderful entertainment for such a cheap price? You want to do this. I'm quite sure you want to do this. So there's two people sitting out there, and I'm beginning to sound like the PBS people, right? Pretty soon I'll have you on the telephones. I'd like to remind you that next week we are going to be given a very special session. I'm not sure lecture is the right word, by Roy Peterson. I'm quite sure you have all seen Roy Peterson's wonderful cartoons in the Vancouver Sun and in many, many other media. And he has prepared a remarkable presentation for you of what it's like to be and how to be a political cartoonist. So don't forget that. That's next Saturday night. And tonight we have a very special presentation as well. We have Dr. Jeffrey M. Hurwit. He's a professor of art history at the University of Oregon. He's a prolific writer. He's a speaker in many forums about the Acropolis of Athens, various other artistic features of ancient Greece, everyday life in Athens, and many aspects of ancient Greece civilization. In 1975, he completed his PhD at Yale in classical art and archaeology, and he has taught at several institutions in the United States and Italy and Greece. He's the author of two books. One is The Art and Culture of Early Greece, and the other, The Athenian Acropolis, History, Mythology, and Archaeology from the Neolithic Era to the Present. A co-edited volume on Berkeleyan Athens is now in press. He comes to us courtesy of the Dorothy Burr Thompson Memorial Lecturer's Distinguished Scholar Series. And Dorothy Burr Thompson was a distinguished scholar who was engaged in the excavation of ancient Athens. She's also the widow of Homer Thompson, for whom this is named, who was the director of the excavations at Athenian Agora. So with great pleasure, I would like to introduce you to Jeffrey Hurwit.
Thank you all very much for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been to Vancouver only once before on a vacation with my family, but I feel as if this has been a vacation. I've been treated very well since my arrival yesterday. Your hospitality has been great. Thank you very much for that. I've also been well instructed in the technology of this cavernous room. It's not the kind of back projection technology that we have back in Oregon, but I've been told what to do. If I screw up, it's my fault and no one else's. Yeah, so they're back there, all right. In 490 BC, the mighty army of the Persian Empire, the grandest empire that the world had ever seen, was cut to pieces by Athenian foot soldiers on this plain, which is the plain of Marathon, located in northeastern Attica. 10 years later, in 480, the Persians came back and took their revenge. In the fall of 480, the Persians besieged and sacked the Athenian Acropolis, destroying the temples and statues and offerings that had been built and dedicated there over the previous century. Works like this calf bearer, perhaps the first large-scale marble statue ever dedicated on the summit, and scores of statues of maidens or chori like this one, were pulled down from their pedestals and broke upon the Acropolis rock. Now, according to a fairly arbitrary but still useful convention, the Acropolis that the Persians destroyed was an archaic Acropolis. And the destruction of 480 marks the beginning of the classical period. And yet, for some decades, classical Athenians undertook no monumental building activity atop the citadel. The Athenians, we are often told in our handbooks, were either content or they were compelled by an oath to leave the early classical Acropolis, the Acropolis in the years between, say, 480 and 450, as they were, as a ruin, as a reminder of Persian impiety, and perhaps also as a way of keeping the psychological wound of the destruction fresh and raw, and so of inciting further action against the barbarians from the east. Now, there was, in fact, more architectural and sculptural activity in the Acropolis in the years between 480 and 450 than is often thought. For example, the statue that you see on your right was, in my opinion, dedicated on the Acropolis in the year or two after the Persian destruction. It is the Critias boy and holds a good claim to being the first statue in the classical style. Yet it remains true that no great temple was begun on the Acropolis in those years. And so there was nothing to compare with what would take place after 450 or 449, when the great Pericles initiated a public works program that transformed the Acropolis and gave Western civilization one of its most familiar and enduring cultural icons, a marble tableau consisting of the Temple of Athena Nike, the Temple of Athena Victory at the entrance, the Propylaea, or gateways to the Acropolis itself, the temple known as the Erechtheion, and of course the building known as the Parthenon. The spirit of the high classical, late 5th century remaking of the Acropolis is vividly captured in a biography of Pericles written by Plutarch. Plutarch's Life of Pericles was written more than 5 centuries after the death of its subject, and it's full of misconceptions. But it does famously assert that, quote, "What brought the greatest pleasure and embellishment to Athens and the greatest astonishment to the rest of men, and what is now Greece's only evidence that her vaunted power and ancient wealth is no fiction, was the construction of the dedications," by which Plutarch means the buildings dedicated to Athena on the Acropolis. And this passage in Plutarch's Life of Pericles even more famously concludes as follows: "But as the works rose, overwhelming in size, yet also inimitable in form and grace, with the craftsmen striving to surpass their craft in the beauty of their workmanship, the most wonderful thing of all was the speed of their work. For while it was thought that each one of these works would take many successive generations to reach an end, all of them were completed at the height of a single administration, for which reason the works of Pericles are to be especially wondered at, being made in so short a time, yet for all time. For in beauty each one was then immediately ancient, and yet each seems fresh and newly made even now. Thus a kind of newness always blooms over them, preserving their appearance untouched by time, as if his works were infused with an ever-fresh breath and an ageless soul." Plutarch's description of the Periclean building program, a program that again was already ancient, 5 centuries old when he described it, has exerted an enormous influence over our modern conception of it. And it is thus still easy to be struck, as Plutarch was, by the freshness and newness of the Periclean Acropolis, by Pericles' radical transformation of the summit of the citadel, by the sense that Pericles and his architects and sculptors began with a clean slate, thanks largely to the Persian destruction of 480, and that they began afresh, unencumbered by the weight of the past. This, I would like to suggest this evening, is not so. In fact, what must have struck the ancient visitor, as I hope it will strike you, is how thoroughly the Periclean Acropolis incorporated older pre-Periclean monuments, both buildings and statues, within it. How the material remains of the past were conscientiously woven into or embedded in the fabric of the Periclean present. How the Periclean remaking of the citadel almost sought its own sanctification by the ingenious use and reverent display of the past. Now, it's true that the physical remains of any Greek sanctuary would have revealed at any one moment a temporal continuum with old and new monuments set side by side. The visitor to classical Delphi, for example, or Olympia, would have seen a variety of monuments set up over a very long time in close array. But in these other sanctuaries, such a juxtaposition of old and new was the result of an organic aging process. Without something cataclysmic, like a Persian sack, to wipe the slate clean, it just couldn't be helped. On the Acropolis, the victim of almost total destruction in 480, the situation was different. The composition of monuments, the playing off of one against the other, was carefully calculated. Pericles' architects and designers had the opportunity, as few others did, to make their sanctuary completely new. What's remarkable, or at least it seems so to me, is how reluctant they were to do so, and how much they wanted to bind what was new together with what was, even for them, old. The Periclean Acropolis not only acknowledged the remains of previous acropolises, it prominently displayed and exploited them, and with that gave the new sanctuary the authority, the venerability, and the legitimacy of the ancient. The earliest monumental construction in the history of the Acropolis was a massive fortification wall, in places 10 meters high and 6 meters thick, that was thrown around the brow of the Acropolis rock at the end of the Bronze Age, in the Late Bronze Age, or in the Mycenaean period, toward the end of the 13th century BC. The wall was built to protect a royal palace a Mycenaean palace that existed, we know, on the summit of the citadel, a palace protected by a fortification wall that would have resembled, in many respects, the Mycenaean citadels that are better preserved elsewhere, for example, at Tiryns or here at Mycenae itself, where the Mycenaean palace located on the summit of the citadel at Mycenae was surrounded by a massive fortification wall, also built in the 13th century BC. Now, the Bronze Age palace on the Acropolis probably went out of use around 1100 or so BC at the end of the Bronze Age, but the Cyclopean wall, as it's called, a wall built of stones so large that the ancient Greeks thought that only those one-eyed giants known as cyclopses could have lifted the stones into place. The late Mycenaean or Cyclopean wall that went around the brow of the Bronze Age Acropolis remained in use long after the Mycenaean palace on the summit went out of use. The Mycenaean wall, once defending the Bronze Age Acropolis, remained the principal fortification of the Acropolis for the next 600 years or so, throughout the so-called Dark Age, throughout the following Archaic period. It was, in fact, this wall, little changed, and here's a stretch of it still preserved near the Acropolis Museum. It was still this wall that defended the Acropolis when the Persians came in 480. Most of its length was almost certainly thrown down by the Persians during the sack, but some parts apparently escaped their wrath. This part near the museum, for example, and perhaps most famously, a stretch near the entrance of the Acropolis. Here, a stretch of wall that you see, Mycenaean or Cyclopean masonry, now draped over with the wires and lighting used for the sound and light show that is held during the summer months in Athens. We're looking at a stretch of wall that is located right here on the map of the Acropolis. Perhaps the best known strip of Cyclopean masonry, Bronze Age stonework still surviving. A bit of wall that actually rests against or abuts the southwest wing of the Periclean or classical propylaea or gateway. Rather, I should say, the propylaea, a plan of which you see here, abuts this wall rather than the other case. The wall, the Cyclopean wall, doesn't abut the propylaea. The propylaea was actually built in this area consciously so that it would fit neatly against the pre-existing Bronze Age remains. Here, for example, is this corner that you see on this slide of the propylaea with Mycenaean masonry below it is this corner on the plan. And when, between 437 and 432, BC, the architect of the propylaea, a man named Menesicles, built his gateway. He actually beveled this corner of the propylaea, the southeast corner of the southwest wing of the propylaea, so that his classical masonry would fit snugly against the surface of the Bronze Age masonry that still stood perhaps 10 meters tall at the end of the 5th century. Rather than dismantle this Mycenaean wall, this Mycenaean relic or monument, so he could build his propylaea without hindrance, he actually beveled that corner of his propylaea so that the new would fit snugly against the old. Fine, squared, classical masonry, marble masonry, set against a wall of irregularly shaped limestone boulders originally built nearly 800 years before. Menesicles and the Periclean Age seem to have regarded these stones with special awe. And this was not the only Bronze Age relic that classical architects on the Acropolis both respected and revealed. The Bronze Age Acropolis had at its western end, which was always and still is, the major entrance to the Acropolis. Just outside of the old Bronze Age entrance to the Acropolis, there was a Cyclopean masonry tower or bastion guarding the approach to the Acropolis on this side. Now, this tower still survives to some degree, and here is a drawing showing the elevation of this Mycenaean or Cyclopean bastion or tower. You're looking at the west elevation. And what you might be able to make out here toward the bottom of the bastion is a double niche shrine, a little area with two openings divided by a vertical stone in which Mycenaean Greeks apparently burned something as they entered the citadel, a double niche shrine as it's called. Now, in the Archaic period, in the 6th century BC, this ancient Bronze Age bastion became, appropriately enough, the site of the cult of Athena Nike, Athena, goddess of victory. Now, this sanctuary, too, was remade in the Periclean Age, in the second half of the 5th century. And around 425 or 524, this little temple, the Temple of Athena Nike, an elegant little jewel box of a temple, was built atop a new, finely sheathed bastion. But the old Mycenaean tower was left inside that bastion. This classical bastion, literally encased within it, entombed, if you will, the old Cyclopean masonry or tower. But remarkably, the architect of the classical project recreated that Bronze Age double-niched shrine in the original bastion in fine ashlar masonry. See it here. And on the north face of the bastion, right here, the architects even left a polygonal hole through which the stones of the Cyclopean tower could be viewed. Okay, so you have on this side a face that is otherwise made of pure ashlar masonry, that is to say, nice rectangular stones neatly laid in horizontal courses. But on the level of the eyes of the average Greek who made his or her way up the ramp leading to the Propylaea, there was this very irregular polygonal hole left in the wall. And as one went up to the Propylaea, one could easily just look to the right, look through this little hole, and see Bronze Age stones within. This is quite literally a high classical window upon the Bronze Age past. The Nike Temple bastion literally opens itself up to a perception and a recognition of its own history, of its own Bronze Age origins. Now, the development of the Acropolis after the Bronze Age, and especially in the Archaic period, let's say the 6th century, is a controversial issue. But most of us agree on one or two things. One of them is that in the late 6th century, somewhere between 525 and 500 or so, a monumental temple to Athena Polias, a temple to Athena, the guardian of the city, was built upon these impressive foundations, which still survive, near the center of the Acropolis summit, just south of the classical Erechtheion. It was in this late 6th century temple that the most sacred statue of Athena was kept, an olive wood image of Athena Polias, a statue so old that not even the Athenians knew where it had come from, and so supposed that it had fallen down from heaven. I wonder whether or not this olive wood image of undeterminable antiquity might not have been another Mycenaean relic that somehow survived the end of the Bronze Age to become the most holy, the most sacrosanct image of Athena on the later Acropolis. And it was, in any case, this temple, its pediments filled with marble sculptures depicting the battle of the gods against the giants, for example, where Athena plays a leading role. It must have been this temple that the Persians attacked with special glee in 480. Well, another thing we all agree on, or most of us do in any case, is that across the way, on the south side of the Acropolis here, upon these massive foundations only discovered during the late 19th century excavations of the Acropolis, a new temple or a new building, which we call the Older Parthenon, was begun in the first exhilarating few years after the Battle of Marathon. Sometime after 490, perhaps in 488 or so, a new temple was built on the south side of the Acropolis, or it was begun anyway, on these massive foundations. This temple was never finished. It was still under construction in 480 when the Persians destroyed whatever there had been built of it to destroy. This drawing on the right by Manolis Kares suggests the state of affairs that most scholars agree, that the older Parthenon had been carried up only to the lower drums of its exterior colonnade when it and the scaffolding that was then being used was destroyed by the Persians in 480. The destruction of these two archaic buildings, though, the Temple of Athena Polias on the north side of the Acropolis, the embryonic older Parthenon on the south, the destruction of these two buildings was not total after all. And neither their physical reality nor their memory could be completely erased. The Temple of Athena Polias, or much of it, must have fallen. And many blocks and column drums of the older Parthenon remain unfinished and are still to be seen here and there on the Acropolis summit. Here's a column drum that's fluting has begun but has not been finished yet. After the Persian destruction, there must have been pieces of these two buildings strewn about the Acropolis. But around 470 or 460, early classical Athenians took parts of both of these archaic buildings. They took triglyphs and metopes from the old Temple of Athena here, and they took column drums, unfinished column drums, from the older Parthenon and built them into a new fortification wall on the Acropolis on the north side. You might just be able to pick out here triglyphs and metopes from the Temple of Athena Polias and unfinished column drums from the older Parthenon, making these remains into a moving display of ruins high above the city of Athens as a looming memorial of Persian sacrilege. And so the archaic Temple of Athena Polias and the late archaic older Parthenon were ruined, but parts of them were transformed into another kind of early classical monument. They became a war memorial, and their heavy foundations remained in place on the summit. The builders of both the classical Erechtheion, which I think was begun or conceived of during Pericles' lifetime, and the classical Parthenon exploited those archaic remains as well. Now, the Erechtheion, which you see here in view and in plan, was not so much a temple as it was a composition of many shrines. It was a sacred multiplex. It not only included a new home for the old statue of Athena Polias, probably displayed in the eastern room of the building, but it also contained shrines or altars to the craftsman god Hephaestus, to a combination god Poseidon Erechtheus, and to a local hero named Butes. Adjoining the Erechtheion on the west, in this area here, this side of the Erechtheion, were the supposed tomb of the legendary Bronze Age King Kecrops, located there on the plan, and the shrine of his good daughter named Pandrosis. Like Kecrops's tomb, Pandrosis's cult had probably always been located in this area on the Acropolis. But the architects of the Erechtheion redefined or reshaped this Pandrosian, and in fact used the north foundations of the foundations of the old archaic temple of Athena Polias as the southern boundary of the new precinct of Pandrosus. You're standing, in other words, in a new classical Pandrosian or sanctuary of Pandrosus, but it is defined on one side by the foundations of the archaic temple of Athena Polias. It is, in fact, upon this same wall that the famous Porch of the Maidens, the Caryatid Porch, in fact rests. The Caryatids stand in the south porch. The south porch is supported by the foundations, the north foundations of the temple of Athena Polias, and the Caryatids also stand essentially above the old primeval tomb of this Bronze Age king, Cecrops himself. I wonder whether the libations that these Caryatids, these columns in female form, were imaginatively about to pour from the offering bowls that we know they held in their hands, one wonders whether these Caryatids were there essentially, imaginatively, to pour libations in honor of the ancient Bronze Age king over whose tomb they in fact stand, honoring a hero of distant legend. So the Erechtheion bears several relationships to earlier structures and sites on the Acropolis. It bears a relationship to the older temple of Athena Polias because the south porch, anyway, rests atop the foundations which helped define the Pandrosian. The Caryatids of the Periclean structure may, in fact, be related to the worship of a Bronze Age hero. The Erechtheion is understood only in relation to its past, and it's nearly the same across the way on the south side of the Acropolis. For there, the greatest of all classical buildings was built upon the deep and mighty foundations originally laid for its late archaic predecessor. That is, the Periclean Parthenon largely rests atop the podium originally built for the older Parthenon. And although this was certainly an economical thing to do, the decision, I think, was also ideological or political. The Periclean Parthenon was, in many ways, a reconstruction of the older Parthenon. Remember, the older Parthenon was a temple that was almost certainly begun in the 480s BC in celebration to thank Athena for the victory at Marathon. And the Periclean Parthenon is also at least partly a monument to Marathon as well, and carries on the purpose that the older Parthenon was originally intended for. In fact, the Parthenon's plan was essentially an expansion of the plan of the earlier building. Here are the superimposed plans of the older Parthenon seen in black with six columns in the facades, and in gray hatching, the plan of the Periclean Parthenon with eight columns in the facades, but except for the widening of the Periclean Parthenon, eight columns wide instead of six, basically the plan of the Periclean Parthenon is essentially the same as that of the older Parthenon. And in fact, hundreds of column drums and blocks that were originally quarried for use in the older Parthenon and which still lay atop the Acropolis were reused or recut for the Periclean building. So, for example, the diameter of the columns of the Periclean Parthenon is exactly the same as the diameter of the columns intended for the older Parthenon. The Parthenon, in essence, is essentially largely built with stones originally quarried for the older Parthenon. It is a recycled temple. The recycling of so much material was, of course, cost-effective. And any economy in a building as expensive as the Parthenon would have been appreciated. But the reuse of older Parthenon stones had symbolic value as well. If the very fabric of the classical Parthenon was largely made up of material from the unfinished, late archaic, older Parthenon, meant to commemorate Marathon but destroyed by the Persians in 480, then the Periclean Parthenon was, in a sense, a completion, maybe even a reincarnation of it. The Periclean building could thus be considered both a monument to Marathon, as its predecessor was, and to all those victories won over the Persians in the meantime, in the decades after the desecration of the Acropolis in 480. Now, the recycled nature of so much of the Parthenon's marble might not have been obvious to most Periclean-era visitors, even if they were aware of the history of the building. A column drum looks like a column drum, I guess. But there was another feature of the new Parthenon that tied the building even more overtly to its past, that directly revealed the architectural and sacred history of this spot on the summit. Manolis Kares, former director of the ongoing Parthenon Restoration Project, has discovered evidence in the north colonnade of the Parthenon, here, for the existence of a small temple, or naiskos, and a round altar. A naiskos and an altar that were left standing in the floor of the north colonnade of the building. This shrine existed on this spot long before the construction of the Parthenon. It was probably even older than the older Parthenon. But whatever its date, when the Periclean Parthenon was built, it was regarded as too important or too sacred to destroy. The Parthenon, in essence, was built over and around this pre-Periclean structure. The classical building contained, acknowledged, absorbed, and displayed an archaic shrine within it. This is not a particularly unusual phenomenon. We might compare modern buildings that incorporate previously existing structures within them, such as the BCE Place Galleria in Toronto, a glass-enclosed mall that was built in 1992 over and around an older bank. I guess banks are the temples of the modern world. Or here in Philadelphia, the Penn Mutual Tower, which rises over of an older facade that stubbornly refused to vacate the premises. Or back in Athens, this modern building, which was built over and around a little Byzantine church just below it. At all events, we do not know what divinity was worshipped in that little temple, that naiskos. But it's a safe bet, I think, that the shrine held an ancient statue of Athena herself. What kind of statue we can't say, but perhaps it was a statue resembling a statue that was depicted on the north metopes in these reliefs on the north side of the Parthenon, metopes that showed episodes from the story of the Trojan War, especially from the night of Troy's destruction. I like to think that the stiff, stylistically archaic statue of Athena that was depicted in this relief, North Metope 25, as it's called, a statue to which Helen runs for safety, because in the next metope, her husband Menelaus, sword drawn, is searching for her, ready to do her harm, because she left Sparta for Troy with Paris and caused the Trojan War and so much suffering. Aphrodite and Eros, or Cupid, stand in Menelaus's way while Helen seeks aid at Athena's statue. Don't worry, when Menelaus finally does catch Helen, she, afraid, reveals her breast. He sees her breast, falls deeply in love with her once again, and takes her back to Sparta, where they live happily ever after. But I like to think, or maybe unhappily ever after, it's a little unclear, I'd like to think that the statue of Athena depicted in this metope might have looked something like the statue that was on display in the naiskos in the north colonnade. That naiskos would have stood about here somewhere. Helen seeking the statue of Athena is here, but it's kind of like an X marks the spot situation. A visitor to the Acropolis might have seen this statue in the metope above and then might have seen a similar statue in the naiskos within the colonnade just below. Well, in any case, the Periclean Parthenon had an earlier archaic shrine embedded within its very fabric. And so, in the opinion of most scholars, did the Periclean Acropolis as a whole have an archaic building standing at its very center. And this is the building that is known, or that is referred to in classical inscriptions and orations after the year 434, as the Opisthotomos. And this word, Opisthotomos, is surely the most exasperating term relating to the history of the classical Acropolis. Every time I hear or see or read the word, I want to reach for a stiff drink, but I'll carry on anyway. Well, the word Opisthotomos usually, or literally means, the room behind, the Opisthotomos. And it normally refers to the back porch, the shallow back porch, of the typical temple cella, the main room within the colonnade of a typical classical temple. That's what the word normally means. But the consensus is that when the word appears in classical inscriptions relating to the Acropolis, it refers specifically to the western part, the back rooms and the porch, of the limestone archaic temple of Athena Polias that was built on these foundations in the late 6th century, a temple that was destroyed by the Persians, a temple that the Athenians, who clearly had to keep the ancient olive wood statue of Athena somewhere after the destruction of 480, restored in order to accommodate the statue in the early classical period. So this repaired makeshift Opisthotomos, according to the theory, the relic of the old temple of Athena Polias, somehow restored, according to the theory, stood right here in the center of the classical Acropolis, while the monuments of the Periclean building program rose all around it. In fact, it stood at least until the middle of the 4th century, when it is referred to for the last time in our sources. That is to say, according to the consensus, this Opisthotomos stood in the center of the Acropolis long after the classical Erechtheion was built just to its north and the Parthenon to its south. In fact, a brand new theory published just last year suggests that much more of the archaic temple of Athena Polias stood whole on the classical Acropolis than even traditional adherents of the Opisthotomos theory believed. Here is a computer model showing an even larger Opisthotomos, a larger relic of the old temple of Athena Polias, still standing in the center of the classical Acropolis with the Erechtheion and the Parthenon to either side. This is what, according to this interpretation, this new theory of the Opisthotomos looked like, with the remains of the archaic temple dominating the classical summit and incidentally obscuring from most angles the Erechtheion nestled into its remains. Now, belief in the existence of the Opisthotomos rests primarily on ambiguous epigraphic and literary rather than on archaeological grounds. For example, there is no physical evidence at all for the rebuilding of any part of the archaic temple of Athena Polias. And if that temple continued to stand on the Acropolis to this extent, to the 4th century, or even to the end of antiquity, as it is thought, one wonders where that great building went to. But whatever the answer to the Opisthotomos question, it is important to consider the implications if some part of the old temple of Athena Polias, large or small, really did remain standing in the classical period. For anyone entering the late 5th and 4th century Acropolis, its presumably still charred limestone walls and columns would have seemed jarringly incongruous in the center
of a sanctuary otherwise composed of buildings made of freshly cut Pentelic marble. This rebuilt structure would have obscured or blocked many views of the elegant caryatid porch of the Erechtheion. Besides, the caryatids themselves would have seemed cramped.
But the party line is that this is what the Periclean Acropolis looked like, at least until the mid-4th century and possibly beyond, a composition of brand new marble buildings revolving around a partly repaired, blackened limestone relic from a bygone age. If the party line is right, and it may be, the only conceivable rationale would have been to bind the new Periclean Acropolis directly to the archaic one destroyed by the Persians, and to suggest that the Acropolis had, like a phoenix, risen from its own ashes. Whether part of the old temple of Athena Polias survived as the Opisthotomus or not, we know that a few archaic statues managed to survive the Persian destruction and decorate the classical citadel. During his tour of the Acropolis in the 2nd century AD, Pausanias, the author of an invaluable travel guide to Greece, saw, for example, an archaic bronze lioness that the Persians evidently missed or ignored, as well as a seated statue of Athena by the archaic sculptor named Endoios. And this badly weathered statue, a statue that was long exposed to the elements in the Acropolis Museum, Acropolis 625, may be the very statue of Athena by Endoios that Pausanias saw. He saw a number of other expressly archaic statues of Athena, of what material he doesn't say, but he says that they still had their limbs, but they were blackened by Persian flames. He doesn't mention this statue, an under-life-size Athena, made by a sculptor named Euaenor and dedicated by Engelatos. But it's possible that it was dedicated on the Acropolis just before the Persians came, that it was only slightly damaged during the sack, and that it was then repaired and rededicated after 480. There is evidence for some recutting around the Gorgon's head on the breastplate or aegis of Athena, indicating that it was repaired. And there is the evidence of this vase in the Metropolitan, painted around 470 or 460, that suggests that this statue was still to be seen on the Acropolis well into the early classical period, if not beyond. And just as some archaic statues continue to stand in the Periclean high classical sanctuary, so did any number of early classical monuments. The great, a colossal bronze statue of Athena, created by Phidias, probably in the late 460s or early 450s. A statue that was said to have been financed from the spoils of war, captured from the Persians at Marathon. And a statue that actually faced slightly to the southwest toward the waters of Salamis, where in 480, the Athenian-led Greek fleet destroyed the Persian armada. This lost bronze statue, itself a monument to the Persian Wars, stood in the open near the pre-Periclean entrance to the Acropolis and greeted the visitor with the image of a peaceful but armed and vigilant Athena. But the Periclean building program left it alone and left it in place. The classical propylaea was virtually aligned with it, with the result that this early classical bronze remained as much a part of the high classical Periclean era visitors' experience of the sanctuary as the colossal gold and ivory Athena, the Athena Parthenos, that Phidias made and installed within the Parthenon itself in 438. These two statues, the bronze Athena and the Athena Parthenos, bracketed the visitor's experience of the Acropolis, the early classical statue at the start of the tour, the high classical Periclean statue near its end. Together, they largely established the thematic unity, the iconographic and ideological choreography of the place. And so, every major element of the Periclean building program was materially or thematically bound
to at least one predecessor, the Propylaea and the Nike Bastion to Mycenaean walls and towers, the Erechtheion and the Parthenon to late archaic temples and shrines, and the classical sanctuary preserved and displayed and exploited earlier statuary and dedications as well. The Periclean Acropolis was thus not completely new. Its makers did not write upon a clean slate. Instead, the Acropolis was a composition in which new buildings and monuments stood upon or beside old ones. And the links were, in most cases, obvious, as easy to grasp as peering through the windows in the Nike Temple Bastion. So what's the meaning of all this? Again, like Delphi or Olympia, or any Greek sanctuary, the Acropolis throughout its history had always assimilated relics of past Acropolises, so that its long history was always in evidence. But the Acropolis experienced something those other sanctuaries did not: virtually complete destruction. A destruction that gave the Athenians the opportunity to rebuild upon a tabula rasa, an opportunity that the Athenians pointedly refused to accept. What's significant about the Periclean Acropolis, it seems to me, what differentiates it from other sanctuaries where continuities were taken for granted, is the self-consciousness of its use and overt exploitation of earlier remains. The Periclean Acropolis, to a degree unknown in any other Greek sanctuary, especially acknowledged, revealed, and reveled in its own archaeology, in the sense of its own past. It may not be coincidental, then, that at least one frieze of the Temple of Athena Nike itself, the frieze located on the south side of the building, represented not a mythological battle like the Greeks against the Amazons or the gods against the giants or the Greeks against the centaurs or something, but, and this is unique in 5th century architectural sculpture, an historical victory, the Battle of Marathon itself, the same battle commemorated by the bronze Athena and by the Parthenon. The Periclean Acropolis thus not only seems conscious of its own archaeological history, it actually represents Athenian political and military history. And so it's probably also not coincidental that the era of the Periclean building program was the era of the writing of the first great historical narratives, the Persian Wars of Herodotus, the Peloponnesian War of Thucydides. Two very different works, to be sure, with two very different conceptions of what history is, but which nonetheless reveal an awareness of the antiquity of monuments. Thucydides, for example, was well aware of the prehistoric origins of the Cyclopean walls to be found on the Acropolis. He was very much aware of how the present was founded upon the deeds of the past, like the Parthenon atop the podium of its late archaic predecessor. Like the prose histories of Herodotus and Thucydides, the classical Acropolis, by incorporating and even displaying earlier monuments within it or on its walls, was a record. It was an attempt to explain itself, how it came to be as it was. And so it was an attempt to reveal its own history, a history as old as the Bronze Age, and so to bind present realities both to past glories, such as Marathon, and to past traumas, such as the Persian sack, the single greatest disaster the ancient Acropolis ever experienced. Despite Plutarch's influential description of its making, of its agelessness, its freshness, and its newness, the Periclean Acropolis was never intended to be completely new, or to pass as untouched by time. The passage of time, the documentation of its own archaeology, was in fact one of its principal themes. With its many windows upon the past, the Periclean Acropolis was meant above all to be a landscape, we might say a marble scape of memory. Thanks very much.
We'll take questions.
Absolutely, sure.
Do you prefer to point them out yourself, or shall I do it?
I'll do it. Doesn't matter. Whatever
sure.
you prefer.
No,
you prefer.
No, it's up to you.
why don't you?
Dr. Hurwit has agreed to take questions. Can we have the
paddle, identify whoever wants to raise their hand and ask questions. I'll try to answer them if I can. Sir? I try to repeat the question. I didn't hear the last part. How they keep the water?
How did they make the roof of the Acropolis watertight? How was that done?
How did they make water? The roof of the Acropolis. The question is, since the Acropolis is drier than Vancouver or I dare say Eugene, but nonetheless, it does rain from time to time. In fact, in the winter, there's quite a lot of water. I believe the question is, how do they keep the roof of the Parthenon watertight? Is that right? Well, the roof of the Parthenon, in fact, the entire Parthenon, with the exception of wooden beams, roof beams, was made of marble. So the roof was marble, and it was covered with marble tiles. And these marble tiles, roof tiles, would have funneled water into gutters called cymas, which would have spouts in the cyma of the Parthenon would have let the water come out.
Other questions?
Sir?
Up there at the back?
Okay. Sorry. Sir?
Up there at the back?
Referring to the recycling of former temples, given that it's on a hill and the size of some of those columns, how do they move these items to position themselves?
I'll repeat the question. How do they move the blocks of stone? Yeah. Yeah, very laboriously. I mean, the stone was quarried on the slopes of Mount Penteli, in quarries on Mount Penteli, and they were taken in carts, dragged with mule teams, ox carts, to Athens. They were worked out roughly in the quarry because you'd want to transport as light a block as you could, but the blocks were transported with animal teams to the Acropolis themselves and then taken up with those same teams to the summit of the Acropolis where they were given the final working. It was a very laborious task, but not a very difficult one technologically. There's a pretty good book about the quarrying of the Parthenon stones, the actual technology of it, with good drawings done by Manolis Kares, whose work I referred to earlier in the lecture. It's come from Penteli to Parthenon, I think it's called. And it's got good drawings that show you the technique of quarrying the stones itself and transporting by means of carts to Athens itself.
I think it's more lifting one on top of the other.
Yeah. Well, there were levers, of course, and there were pulleys. The question is, how did the Persians destroy the buildings and how long did it take? Judging from our historical sources, it didn't take them very long. It took them anywhere from a few hours, maybe to a couple of days, to do their dirty work on the Acropolis. That's in 480. They came back again the following year, and they destroyed even more of the city of Athens. How did they destroy these things? Well, they did it in various ways. Buildings they would have destroyed by putting ropes around columns, and if you just manage to pull out one column, of course, or one drum of from a column, a large part of the monument's going to collapse. The wooden parts of the temples, the scaffolding around the embryonic older Parthenon would have been burned, and there are, in fact, marks, if you know where to look, in the foundations of the Parthenon, where you can see how burning wooden beams fell against the marble. Marble doesn't burn, it calcines, it gets dark or it becomes friable, but there are places where you can see the tremendous effects of the fires
on the remains of the older Parthenon. Some of the blocks were submitted to tremendous heat. The marble is just sort of cracking, nearly coming apart. But they would have done other kinds of damage too. I mean, the Temple of Athena Polias would have had a lot of flammable material, peploi, woven robes that were given to the statue of Athena Polias every year would have been stored inside the Temple of Athena Polias, and they would have gone up in smoke. The Persians would have knocked down vases that were on pedestals or on shelves or on tables. They would have stolen the gold and the silver. They would have knocked statues off their pedestals, sometimes by dragging them down. Sometimes they would mutilate statues by knocking off their noses, just by going like that. It was regarded in Persia as a means of destruction something that's very nasty to cut off somebody's nose. You could do it to statues too. And there are many examples of statues that are otherwise pretty well preserved on the Acropolis, but that have their noses missing. It could be because they just fell on their nose. It could be because somebody, a Persian with a mallet or something, just went like that. So there was lots of different ways to wreak havoc on the Acropolis in 480. Two good questions. Well, the first one, remind me about the second one if I forget about it. The first one was about the length of the Periclean building program, how long it took, and what was included. And was there one architect? Well, Plutarch, whose life of Pericles I referred to, gives you the impression that Phidias, the sculptor of both the bronze Athena and the statue of Athena Parthenos, was a kind of general supervisor, that the buildings had their own architects. Echinus and Callicrates did the Parthenon, Menesicles did the Propylaea. I think he also did the Erechtheion, but nobody says that exactly. But that Phidias was in charge of the whole project. He was the minister of culture, or he was the general supervisor. That's the impression you get from Plutarch, an impression that's almost certainly wrong. Phidias, the only thing we know that Phidias did was to create the statue of Athena Parthenos. It's not even likely that he had much to do with the rest of the sculpture of the Parthenon itself. In fact, we know that after 438, when the statue of Athena Parthenos was dedicated, Phidias went to Olympia to create the statue of Zeus at Olympia and wasn't even in Athens when a lot of the work on the Parthenon, the carving of the pediments, for example, took place. So Plutarch's a little misleading. What we do have are inscriptions, and we also know a lot about Athenian democracy, enough to tell us that every separate monument had to be voted upon separately by the Athenian people in citizen assembly, and that each project had its own team of supervisors. So each monument had a board of directors, you might say, supervising its creation, its building, or in the case of a sculpture, its creation. And all of these monuments were voted for by the citizen assembly. It's very much a democratic project. Plutarch's also misleading in a lot of other ways. He tells us, for example, that one of Pericles' goals in launching this building program was to give work to the Athenians, and so that the Athenian people should benefit from the wealth of the Athenian Empire, which he'd been building, and they would put people to work building these monuments as if he were Roosevelt and this was the WPA project or something of the sort. And that's not true either. I mean, there was no problem with labor in the 5th century Athens. If anything, it was a labor shortage. There was not enough people to hire, and so that's not really an issue. Plutarch is writing in the days of the Roman Emperor Trajan, and he conceives of the building project of Pericles much in the same way as Trajan's building programs took place, but they're very different projects altogether. Well, yes and no, because
our conception of how the Periclean building program developed has undergone some changes over the last few years. Two of the buildings on the Acropolis, the Temple of Athena Nike and the Erechtheion, it used to be thought, dated to the 420s. Pericles died in 429 of the plague. At least these two buildings were not completed until long after his death. And so in what sense could they be called part of the Periclean building program? So people included the Temple of Athena Nike and the Erechtheion as a matter of convenience rather than of true accuracy. But as it happens now, because of some of the recent studies being done as a result of the Periclean, of the restoration projects going on in the Acropolis, it now appears that the Erechtheion was at least conceived of in the 430s, and probably the Temple of Athena Nike too. So even though they weren't built until later on in the 5th century after Pericles' death, they do seem to have been part of his original, or somebody's original, conception of what the Athenian Acropolis was going to look like. They didn't get to those buildings until a little later, but they did apparently include them as part of the master plan, which would have been developed in the early 440s. The Parthenon was built and decorated in 15 years. From 447 to 432, the Propylaea from 437 to 432. In 15 years, you have the construction of the Parthenon, the Propylaea, probably the first bit of working on the Erechtheion and the Temple of Athena Nike. The work again continued till later in the century.
There's another question.
I didn't answer the second really? Part of his question, but maybe I'll ask that one. Come back to that. Well, at the present time, work on the Parthenon continues. Restoration work on the Parthenon began in 1975, I think. Everything was supposed to be done by 1995, but things got very complicated. Many more blocks of the Parthenon have been rediscovered that they want to put back into the building as they restore it. To tell you the truth, I think now the goal is to finish everything by 2004, the Olympics, but that's not going to happen. The Erechtheion has been restored. It is complete, although they go back to it from time to time to fix up a few things. Right now, as of last summer when I was there, the Temple of Athena Nike no longer exists. It is completely gone. It's been taken down block by block. It'll be put back the right way. It's been restored several times in the past incorrectly. It's now being, again, taken apart stone by stone, and it's going to be put back together the right way, with titanium dowels and pins instead of iron ones that have done so much damage. And the Propylaea is still being worked on. So except for the Erechtheion, major work is going on the other monuments.
Did they want to change that structure to be able to get access to the Parthenon?
Whether you'll be able to get access to the Parthenon when it's all done? Well, yeah, you used to be able to wander on the Acropolis as you would. I used to have my lunch inside the Parthenon when I was a student there. You can't do that anymore because of the restoration project and to preserve the stones and to protect people, because bits and pieces of the Parthenon tended to fall on people from time to time. They've closed off these buildings, and you now have roped, concreted walkways that lead tourists where you're supposed to go, and so you don't have the freedom of movement that you once did. Once the restoration project's over, I don't know what the intention is, whether they'll let you back in the building or not. I would hope so.
Gentleman up in the middle here, up above.
Now, the question is, can I back myself up with any literary references indicating that what I said actually happened? No. Darn it. And we have very, as a matter of fact, we have very few literary references to the Acropolis in ancient literature. You'd think that in Greek tragedies or histories or whatever, you'd have people writing about the Acropolis all the time, but you don't. Sorry, it's all speculative.
Woman up at the back there?
This is the question, are there other examples in Greece where you have this kind of building that upon earlier buildings and that also display the earlier remains? And to my knowledge, this is the most spectacular example of it. It's certainly true at many other sanctuaries. Later buildings are built atop the remains of earlier ones. Pick a sanctuary and you can find a building that was built on a predecessor. But not in quite the same way as I think you find on the Acropolis, where there is, as I mentioned, the self-consciousness of the display of the earlier remains, like the Naiskos in the north colonnade of the Parthenon, or the windows in the Nike temple bastion. I just don't think you have that same character of display. Yeah. The question is, where did all these materials come from? And again, the marble, for example, the marble comes from Mount Penteli. It's Pentelic marble in Attica itself, 10 miles away or so. That's the principal material. The wood is of various kinds. Some of it seems to have been imported from other lands. Cypress wood, for example, might have come, and cedar is mentioned. That might have come, obviously, from Lebanon. The Athena Parthenos, the statue for the interior of the Parthenon, was made of gold and ivory, predominantly, on a wooden core. The gold, the sources of the gold, we don't know, but the ivory would have come from elephant tusks, or perhaps hippopotami teeth is another source of ivory. So the materials of the buildings would have come locally and from far afield as well. What put me wise to Plutarch getting his story wrong? Well, as vivid and as wonderful as the description is, it doesn't match with inscriptions that we have. We have hundreds of inscriptions from the classical period and from the classical Acropolis, and they don't jibe with what he tells us. I mean, he has no knowledge of these epistati, these boards of directors that managed each project. He simply doesn't mention them. But we have inscriptions saying that the epistati of the Parthenon did this in a given year, or the epistati, the supervisors, of the Erechtheion did this in a given year. And so we have contemporary evidence from the 5th century that belies what he tells us 500 years later. I mean, it's not his fault. I mean, he's just dealing with a very long period of time separates him from Pericles Athens. So,
gentlemen up there.
No, I'm very unfamiliar with medieval guilds, I'm afraid. I know nothing after the year 330 AD. I'm not kidding. Everything's modern after that. The epistati were annually elected. They were elected or appointed by the citizen assembly each year, done almost randomly as part of an electoral process, kind of like electing presidents in the United States. Pericles himself was one of the epistati of the Athena Parthenos in a year. And whether that was just randomly chosen or whether he said, I want to get on that board, we don't know. But it was just one year. So these were annual appointments. Which, think about that. I mean, you have boards of supervisors changing every year.
for a project like the Parthenon, is that the best way of doing things? I don't know.
There's a question down here right in front of you.
Yeah.
Sutra obviously seems to be referring to a glistening Acropolis. Can you comment on the use of color in the original?
The Plutarch, if you read Plutarch, the questioner is quite right. You get the sense of Plutarch describing a virtually glistening, sparkling Acropolis. And the question is, talk about the use of color on the Acropolis and paint. And this, of course, is something that is very easy for us all to forget, given our romantic, capital R, romantic heritage. But ancient marble sculpture and architecture was painted, sometimes quite vividly painted. Whether this paint was renewed over time and whether even Plutarch, writing in the second century AD or so, saw the same kind of paint that would have been used to decorate the sculptures and architectural features of the Parthenon, I don't know. But we have to think away these white or honey-colored marble structures glistening in the bright Aegean sunlight and rethink them with great deep reds and blues and greens and yellows and so on, picking out the details, both of architectural features and, above all, the sculptures on the building, which would have, incidentally, paint on these sculptures would have made them much more visible to normal-sized human beings walking below them on the ground of the Acropolis. It would be easier to see a painted metope or a painted pedimental figure than simply a plain white one placed, you know, meters over your head. So, again, these marble structures and sculptures were vividly painted.
There was one question here. Yes, there it is. Thank you.
I'm curious about whether the Elgin marbles will ever go back.
The question is, the questioner wonders whether the Elgin marbles will ever go back to Greece. Next question. No. Do you want to know my own hopes or opinions or both? Okay. My hope is that they will return to Greece. That's where I think they belong. And I know it might set all kinds of precedents for other museums having to return other stuff. And I think the Elgin marbles are a special case. I think an argument can be made that the Louvre doesn't have to return all of its Assyrian sculpture, or the Met, all of its Greek vases, or whatever. I mean, I think we can make an argument why the Parthenon marbles are so different. So I hope they will and be returned. I think my own personal solution to the quandary would be for the British to return the marbles under permanent loan to Athens, so that the British technically retain ownership of them, but that they are on display in Athens.
One last question.
As of November 1999, as I was gazing upon these marbles in the British Museum, I was assured they will not be returned.
I meant to express to you my own hopes rather than what I think. What I think the British will actually do. Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue. I will say this. In American law schools, there's a famous competition held every year on international law. And like every fourth year, I think, there's a national competition, a mock trial. And the subject is, should the Elgin marbles be returned? And a subsidiary question is, do the British own them legally? Every year, every time the mock trial is held, it turns out that the British own the Elgin marbles legally. It's not a matter of legality. It's a matter of morality and best wishes. And I think that in those terms, the marbles should be returned. Do I think that'll be in my lifetime? I'm afraid not.
I think on that note, we'll have to stop, but you can certainly talk with Dr. Hurwitz afterwards. And I'm going to ask Hector Williams, who, as you know, is a very fine architect. archaeologist himself, and he's going to give our thank you for the evening. Thank you very much, Dr. Hurwitz.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's hard to believe the Acropolis is a monument put together by committees, but it's attesting, once again, the Greek genius. Our speaker tonight has brought us a fresh view of these world-famous monuments, these sermons in stone that mean so much to so many people. And I think he has shown how each generation must turn to them again, investigate them again in their own way, and bring fresh viewpoints to bear on them. And your applause tonight and your presence here, I think, attests very well to the superb job that Professor Hurwitz has done in bringing us the uses of the past on the Athenian Acropolis. On behalf of us all, thank you again.